Well, thank you for inviting me. I've been doing the past month or so a lot of reading on Mahatma Gandhi. He's an interesting fellow, had a lot of, I think, useful things to say, but it's not only what he said that's important. Much more important, I'm sure he would agree, is what he did. And what for me is the most remarkable and inspiring thing about Gandhi is that he took the most despised members of Indian society, Hindu Indian society, first of all what were called the untouchables, or what he would call the Harijans, the children of God, and then second of all the Muslims of India, and he made his cause, the two main causes of his adult life, were actually not directly British, not directly independence from England. His two main causes were trying to achieve equality for the untouchables in India, and secondly, fighting against the odds to achieve Hindu-Muslim unity. Those were his two main causes. His third, to try to resurrect the spinning wheel, we can leave aside for a moment. And that's an inspiration to me, and it tells me I'm very happy to be here today, because Muslims are now under assault in our society and under assault in the West in general. And if you're a moral human being, and if you take seriously the inspiration of someone like Gandhi, then that's where you should be. You should be among those who are suffering most, who are persecuted most, and who are being unjustly mistreated by society. And for me, the question is only, and I don't say it as false modesty, I say it in truth. The only question is whether I'm worthy of you. That's the real challenge for me. When you read Gandhi, he tried to be very self-critical and humble. And he was very open about his flaws as a human being. I don't have quite his ability to broadcast to the world my flaws, as he did, but I'm very aware of them. And so for me, the real challenge is to make myself worthy of this audience, and you'll have to judge whether I am or not. I'm going to do two things. Well, I'm going to make two comments briefly, or at least two strategic decisions. Number one, there are a lot of younger people here, very intelligent people, well-educated people. I was driven here by a car full of medical doctors. I felt I was back in my Jewish neighborhood in Brooklyn. Everybody is a doctor. You're smart, you're educated, and you're also committed. It's important what's happening in the world. And so my first strategic decision is I'm going to cut short the remarks I was going to make because the hour is a little late, because I want to leave more time to have a real genuine dialogue with the people in the audience. There are many topics I know you want to ask about: Lebanon, the Israel lobby, maybe even the economy, the presidential election, and I won't obviously be able to cover all those areas in my prepared remarks, but I would happily want to engage in a dialogue with you. And the second strategic decision I'm going to ask the people who are the organizers, I've never liked written questions. I prefer to let people speak their mind, and so we can go back and forth. And when the audience gets tired of the back and forth, you can tell the person politely to sit down. But let's try to have a real dialogue with the audience, since I think it would be useful. I was, for a time, a college professor, and As most students in this room know, professors don't take written questions. They have to answer on their feet. Okay, having said that, I'll try to limit myself to 45 minutes or less, and then open it up for discussion with everyone, including the people sitting up on stage. What I want to do is basically three things. I want to first sketch basically what the picture looks like now in the American scene on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Where is public opinion now? What are people thinking and saying as far as we can judge? Number two, to try to take account of why have things changed? Because as I'll try to illustrate, things have significantly changed for the better in the United States. And the third thing I want to do, a number of people separately made the same request of me. They said, you have a young audience here, they're concerned people, but they don't know what to do. So can you please give us some suggestions of what we as a concerned Muslim community can do? And that's how I'll end my remarks, by trying to give, in my opinion, useful things that we can do. So let me first begin with what the picture looks like in the United States, as far as you can tell from public opinion polls and surveys. It's no surprise to anyone in this room that Americans overwhelmingly support Israel as against the Palestinians if they have to choose between the two. On the other hand, Americans have consistently stated that they want American policy in the Middle East to be even-handed, not to support either side uncritically. Number three, Americans have overwhelmingly stated that they feel that Israel is not doing its part in trying to resolve the conflict. Number four, Americans overwhelmingly and consistently over a long period have supported a two-state settlement along the June 1967 border. That means a full withdrawal from the territories Israel occupied in the June 1967 war. And finally, you can say as a broad generalization that Israel has a lot of support among Americans. The support is wide, but it's not very deep. There are many people here in this room who are on college campuses or recently graduated from a college campus, and I suspect the experience has been that pro-Israel events nowadays draw very few non-Jewish students on campus. There is a general support, but it's not a deep support. There's no sense of commitment. So last night or yesterday, during the demonstrations against President Ahmadinejad, I could say with virtual certainty, not even having been there, that probably 90% or more of the demonstrators would have been Jewish Americans, very few non-Jewish Americans. That's a couple of other facts which are useful to mention. If you look at the public opinion polls, American support for countries like the United Kingdom, England, and Japan is much greater than the support for Israel. Support for Israel is roughly equal to countries like, American support for Israel is roughly equal to countries like American support for India and Mexico, which is not a particularly high number. And I know there are many Lebanese in this room today, and the coverage of that 2006 war in the American media was wretched and very prejudiced against the Lebanese. Nonetheless, despite the coverage, which was, as it were, pro-Israel, the polls showed that half or more of Americans held Israel and Hezbollah equally to blame for the war, which was a surprising result. You would have expected, given the media coverage, it would have been overwhelmingly anti-Hezbollah, but that was not the case. It was roughly equal, blame that was attributed to Israel and Hezbollah for the war. The most striking indication of this change in American public opinion was already alluded to by one of the speakers, and that was the Jimmy Carter phenomenon. When Jimmy Carter came out with his book, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid, the pro-Israel organizations orchestrated a very dirty campaign to discredit him. They said he was anti-Semitic. They said he was a Holocaust denier. They said he was a supporter of terrorism. They said he was a supporter of Nazism. They pulled all the stoppers in order to try to discredit him. And even though they worked overtime trying to discredit Jimmy Carter, nonetheless, his book sold in hardcover 300,000 copies, which is a very impressive showing. He was number one on the bestseller list for a couple of months at a time. And even when Jimmy Carter went to the oldest and most respected Jewish university in the United States to speak, he went to Brandeis University. The audience of 2,000 was overwhelmingly Jewish. Jimmy Carter got two standing ovations. When the Professor Dershowitz went up to the podium to respond after Carter spoke, the reports were at least half the audience walked out before he even opened his mouth. And that's at Brandeis University. It's clear something is changing, and it's most notable what's changing among American Jews. So if you look at the polls, American Jews are constantly being polled. And if you look at the polls, it's quite clear, to quote the main American Jewish pollster, a fellow named Stephen Cohen, he writes as follows: "The attachment of American Jews to Israel has weakened measurably, continuing a long-term trend. Jews are less likely than in the past to care about Israel, to talk about Israel, or to engage in pro-Israeli activities. About 30% of American Jews say they, quote, feel distant from Israel. A strong majority of American Jews say, even if Iran has nuclear weapons, the United States should not attack Iran. Among Jews under 40 years of age, about 40% have a low attachment to Israel, and about half, amazingly, about half of Jews under 35 years of age say, if Israel were destroyed, they would not consider it a personal tragedy. Well, I don't really agree with that, but we'll get to it later. The point I'm simply trying to make for the moment is, it's clear that support for Israel, not only among Americans in general, but in particular among American Jews, has dropped off considerably, to use the fancy word, precipitously. That means like the banks, the current banks. One of my banks went broke yesterday. My brother called me up this morning to tell me, and he then called me up later to say, my other bank now has one star. So if you know about banking, I had to do a lot of quick phone calls before I came here. And that's sort of like where support for Israel is going. It's not yet one star, but you could say on a scale of 1 to 5 stars, it's probably now down to about 2.5 stars. And the question is, why? What's happened? Why are Americans in general, and American Jews in particular, why are they souring on Israel? Or as they call it, distancing themselves from Israel. And there are all sorts of theories. My own view is that much more is now known about the history of the conflict, about Israel's real human rights record, and about the diplomacy in the conflict. Much more is now known. American Jews in general are liberal in their views. They tend to support the rule of law, human rights, and so forth. And it's now become more and more difficult to be liberal in your political opinions and your social opinions, and at the same time to support Israel, because too much is now known. And let me just give you a few examples. For those people who are older in the room, and they are actually a small number, of which I think I'm going to soon have to include myself among them, you will remember, you say, about 20, 25 years ago, the question, the historical question, that always used to be debated was, how did the Palestinians become refugees in 1948? How many people remember those days where that question always was debated? Those are the people over 50 in the room. And the claim used to be made that the Arab armies were about to invade Palestine after Israel declared its independence, and then the Arab armies told the Palestinians to leave their homes and clear the field for the invading Arab armies, and that the Palestinians were told, after the war is over, after we've driven the Jews into the sea, then you can return to your homes. And for a very long time, many people believed that. In fact, that's what most textbooks said. And then about in the late 1980s, a number of historians, most of whom, but not all of whom, Israeli historians, began looking at the historical record, and they say it just ain't so. There's no evidence that the Arab armies told the Palestinians to flee. That's just all made up. It's a fiction. And then, in fact, what really happened in 1948, and many of the Israeli scholars themselves say it, what happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing. The Palestinians were systematically expelled from their homes in 1948. In fact, if you take one Israeli historian, quite right-wing, very conservative, in fact, you can say he's pretty much a maniac, a fellow named Benny Morris, he says that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine was built into the Zionist idea, and that it was inevitable for a simple reason. You want to create a Jewish state in an area which is overwhelmingly not Jewish. And the only way you can do that, the only way you can square that circle, is by ridding that area of the indigenous population. If you take the question of, let's leave aside the history now, you take the question of the human rights issue. There was a time when most people believed Israel had an excellent human rights record. The expression that was used, again, younger people probably won't know it, but it was very common to say that Israel practiced what was called purity of arms. That is to say, it was the most moral army in the world, and it would never stoop to the kinds of tactics that most other armies use during war. So you take a thing like torture. Nowadays, if you open up reports by Amnesty International, the main human rights organization in the world, they say openly Israel was practicing torture on Palestinian detainees already right after the June 1967 war. But, and this is the important point, that's not what Amnesty International was saying in the 1970s, in the 1980s, not until 1990-91. Up until then, human rights organizations were very fearful of being critical of Israel, for good reasons and bad reasons. The good reasons were they felt, well, Israel is an outcome of the Nazi Holocaust, and so we shouldn't be too hard on them. The bad reason was Jews tend to be liberal, and that means they tend to support liberal causes, which means a lot of Amnesty International money came from liberal Jews. And they were very fearful, if we start criticizing Israel too much, they will pull the plug on organizations like Amnesty. So what changed? 1987 is the first Palestinian Intifada, and torture becomes epidemic in the occupied territories. The estimates are between 1987 and 1993, probably around 20 to 30,000 Palestinian detainees were tortured, which is a huge percentage considering the adult male population in the occupied territories at the time. So number one, you had an epidemic use of torture by Israel. And number two, now Israeli human rights organizations begin to denounce Israel's human rights record. So organizations like Amnesty International and later Human Rights Watch, they now can say, look, we're not accusing Israel of torture. We're simply reporting what Israeli human rights organizations themselves are saying. And so Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, they now had a moral cover when they started to accuse Israel of torture. And by the mid-1990s, if you open up any of the human rights organization reports, they were saying that Israel systematically, methodically tortures Palestinian detainees. The numbers were about, you could say, about 80 to 90% of Palestinians who were arrested during that period were subjected to ill treatment or torture. Well, the historical record is now clearer. The human rights record is now clearer. And in addition, and what's important for what I'll get to in a few moments, the record on how to resolve the conflict has become much clearer. It's a fact that's not well known, regrettably, but every year, the United Nations General Assembly in November, it votes on a resolution called Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question, every year. And the settlement basically is, everybody in this room knows it, it's the two-state settlement. What does it mean? Number one, Israel has to fully withdraw from the territories it occupied in June 1967. Number two, East Jerusalem was occupied in June 1967. Therefore, Israel has to fully withdraw from East Jerusalem. Number three, the settlements that Israel has built, they are all illegal under international law. And number four, Israel has to allow the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes or some sort of compensation for what was for the suffering they endured in 1948. Those are the basic terms of the UN General Assembly resolution. Now, it may come as a surprise to many of you in the room. Every year, and you can check it yourself, actually it's coming up now because we're heading towards November, every year the vote is the same. It's the whole world on one side, and the United States, Israel, and five little islands in the Pacific on the other side. So you take this past year, the vote was 161 to 7. The whole world on one side, on the other side, the United States, Israel, Nauru, that's N-A-U-R-U, Palau, P-A-L-A-U, Micronesia, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. That's it. In fact, you always hear in the news how controversial the Israel-Palestine conflict is. It is, in fact, among, if not, the least controversial conflict in the world today. There is no dispute, no debate about the proper legal framework and political framework for resolving the conflict. Well, some people say you can't trust the United Nations because it's controlled by them, whoever the them happens to be in any particular decade. It used to be the Soviet Third World Bloc. Now it's called the Islamic Bloc. It changes, but okay. Let's say that's true. You can't trust the UN General Assembly. Great Britain is anti-Semitic, France is anti-Semitic, Sweden is anti-Semitic, Norway is anti-Semitic, Burundi is anti-Semitic, Zimbabwe is anti-Semitic, Congo is anti-Semitic. They're all anti-Semitic. Okay. But then you have a problem. July 2004, the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, they have to answer the question whether the wall that Israel is building in the occupied territories is illegal. And before they answer that question, they have to answer all sorts of other questions, like number one, does Israel have any title to the West Bank and Gaza? The International Court of Justice says no. Under international law, it's illegal to acquire territory by war. Israel acquired the West Bank and Gaza by war. Therefore, Israel has no title to the West Bank and Gaza. Now, as you know, the wall cuts right through East Jerusalem. So the International Court of Justice has to ask the question, does Israel have any right to East Jerusalem? The International Court of Justice says, well, Israel acquired East Jerusalem in the course of a war, and it's illegal to acquire territory by war. And therefore, the highest judicial body in the world says, East Jerusalem, and they are very clear, East Jerusalem is, and now I'm quoting them, occupied Palestinian territory. No debate, no discussion. Now this wall takes this very, what's called a sinuous, that's like a snake, a sinuous path, and then takes in all of those settlements that Israel is building. So the International Court of Justice has to ask the question, are those settlements which this wall is taking, are they legal under international law? The highest judicial body in the world says, well, that's really a no-brainer. Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention says it's illegal for an occupying country to transfer its population to occupied land. It says all the settlements are illegal. On all the crucial questions, Israel's positions were rejected by the highest judicial body in the world. But that's only half the story. The other half is the vote was 14-1. It was not even close. These are not controversial questions. To show you how uncontroversial they are, the one negative vote was cast by the American judge, Thomas Bergenthal. But Bergenthal said in his statement, he said, in fact, I agree with a lot of what the majority said. And on the key question, the question of those settlements, that 15 judge, the only one who cast a negative vote, he said, I agree. There can be no question but that all of those settlements are illegal under international law. So on the key question, the vote was 15-0. It's very hard in the face of the historical record, in the face of the human rights record, in the face of the legal and diplomatic record, it's now very difficult to defend Israel's position in public. And that's why, in my opinion, its support is rapidly diminishing. And that leads me to the last topic, and actually I'm going to keep well within my time, so I'm glad about that, namely, Well, what is to be done? What should we do? What would be my recommendation about what should be done? And as I said at the beginning of my remarks, I've been reading a lot of Gandhi lately, actually trying to read him to figure out what can be done. That's been my main interest, though he's very interesting on many topics. Some of you may know that the name he gave to his strategy for trying to end the British occupation of India and before to improve the treatment of Indians in South Africa. Anyone know what the word he used was? Yeah, say. Satyagraha, but maybe you pronounce it better than, are you Indian? Yeah, but okay, so say because you have the better pronunciation. Satyagraha. I think it was Satyagraha, but Satyagraha. Okay. What struck me about that word, Satyagraha, that was the name he gave, Satyagraha. What struck me about the word was the definition, what he meant by it. And what he meant by it, the English translation would be, hold on to the truth. Hold on to the truth. And I think personally, that has to be our strategy, to hold on to the truth, to learn the actual record, to learn the historical record, to learn the human rights record, to learn the diplomatic record, to learn the legal record, and to force people to confront the truth about what's going on and the fact that it's been universally condemned what Israel is doing. So what does that mean as a practical matter? That was a generalization. What does Satyagraha mean as a practical matter, holding on to the truth? By the way, just since there's an African American on the dais, when I heard hold on to the truth, of course I thought of the African American spiritual, keep your eyes on the prize and hold on. And I think it's the same basic principle, keep your eyes on the prize, which meant remember what you're doing, what your purpose is, what your goal is. And then hold on in the actual spiritual meant hold on to the plow, but it means, you know, get a firm grasp on your aim, and then you have to work towards it. Never forget what your aim is. Keep your eyes on the prize, or keep your hold on to the truth. But what does it mean as a practical matter? And here I'm going to be a little critical of our side. Number one, I mentioned to you the judgment of the International Court of Justice and the UN General Assembly resolution. The fact of the matter is, I would guess probably 90% of the people in this room aren't even aware of those facts. Now let's look at a comparison. Some people say, who cares what the General Assembly says? Who cares what the International Court says? They have no power. They don't have troops. They don't have weapons. These resolutions, these court decisions, they're meaningless. Many people believe that. But it's not true at all. They are very powerful weapons if you learn how to use them. And here it's useful, I think, to learn from the other side. What do I mean? I would guess nearly everyone in this room has heard of the Balfour Declaration. How many people have heard of the Balfour Declaration? Raise your hand. Okay, look around. I would guess nearly everyone in this room has heard of the UN partition resolution in 1947, which divided Palestine roughly in half. How many people have heard of the partition resolution? Well, look around. Now here's the tragedy. The International Court decision in July 2004, it was the equivalent of the Balfour Declaration. The Palestinians won everything. They won on the borders, they won on Jerusalem, they won on the settlements. It was a total defeat for Israel, a complete victory for the Palestinians. How many people heard of that decision? Look around. You see? That's the problem. The Zionist movement made sure everyone knew the Balfour Declaration. They made sure everyone knew the partition resolution. How many people know every year the UN vote on Palestine, every year for the past 15 years, has been the whole world on one side, the US and Israel on the other? How many know that? Look around. Now, that vote carries much more legitimacy than the partition resolution. The partition resolution, the vote was 35-13-10. It was very close. The vote on the UN in the past years has been overwhelming. It's been over a 15-year period. But the Zionist movement made sure everyone knows that partition resolution. Our side does nothing. We have weapons as powerful as the Balfour Declaration and the partition resolution, but we never use them. In fact, what's even more tragic, most of us don't even know them. Now, some people say, well, these resolutions, the difference is that in the case of Israel, or before that, the Zionist movement, they were able to get these, the Balfour Declaration, they were able to get the partition resolution because it served the interests of imperialism. And that's why they were able to get the Balfour Declaration and the partition resolution. And they didn't really have to work for them because the imperialists wanted them to set up Israel as a garrison state to protect American, well, British and then American interests in the region. But that's not true at all. There was nothing inevitable about the Balfour Declaration or the partition resolution. In each case, the Zionist movement had to work very hard. They were very well organized. They were very committed. They were willing to make the sacrifices. And we should recognize those facts and learn from them. It wasn't even as if they got the Balfour Declaration, they got the partition resolution, and the struggle was over. That's not true. The British, immediately after issuing the Balfour Declaration, they had second thoughts. They said, maybe this isn't such a smart idea. And each time they tried to retreat, the Zionist movement would organize again, put more pressure, mobilize public opinion. And it happened over and over again until, as some of you know, 1939, the British do withdraw the Balfour Declaration. They say, we have a big war now brewing with Germany. We want the Arabs on our side. So if we want the Arabs on our side, we better get rid of this mandate to create a Jewish home in Palestine. 1947, President Truman has to make a decision. Should he support partition of Palestine, the partition resolution? Most of his advisors are telling him, don't do it. You're going to have big problems with the Arab world. if you support that partition resolution. Truman decides, he comes under a lot of pressure from the Zionist movement, he decides to do it in November 1947. But then already by February 1948, his advisors are saying, there's trouble in Palestine, there's a civil war, get rid of your support for partition. And in February, he's ready to do it. He's ready to withdraw. He goes to the UN and he says, let's set up an international trusteeship over Palestine. Let's forget partition. The Zionist movement says, oh no, you don't. You agree to partition. And they organize and they mobilize, very disciplined, very committed. And to my thinking, that's a lesson that we have to learn. You know, it's the expression, God helps those who help themselves. You have to mobilize, you have to be serious, you have to show commitment, and you have to be willing, and obviously for most of the people in the audience, it's much greater than my own, but you have to have a willingness to make sacrifices if you really want to see a just cause succeed. What should not be done? I say you have to mobilize, organize, hold on to the truth. What shouldn't be done? In my opinion, and there'll probably be disagreement with people on the panel, I don't think we should involve ourselves in ideological questions like, are you or are you not a Zionist? I don't care if you're a Zionist. It's absolutely a meaningless question to me. And I happen to have written my doctoral dissertation on the topic, so I have some investment in it. But I don't think it's a useful question. I think the useful question to ask is not whether or not you're a Zionist, but do you support the ethnic cleansing of Palestine? Israeli historians said what happened in 48 was an ethnic cleansing. Do you support it? Or do you support torture? All human rights organizations says Israel routinely tortures Palestinian detainees. Do you support that? Do you support house demolitions? Under international law, house demolitions are collective punishment. Do you support that? Or Israel's built a road system in the occupied territories, which is for Jews only. Do you support a Jews-only road system? Or Israel has built about 460,000 Jews in Jewish-only settlements. Do you support Jewish-only settlements? I think we have to stick to the facts. It's not as much fun as to use the rhetoric, you know, Zionist this and Zionist that. But I don't think that kind of rhetoric convinces anyone. And that's exactly what the other side wants, to get us involved in an abstract ideological struggle and not confront the facts. So that's the first thing I don't think should be done. We have to also be careful about sticking to the facts. No exaggerations. You don't have to exaggerate. The reality is awful enough. You don't have to embellish the facts, falsify the facts, misrepresent them. Just stick to the factual record. I'll just say publicly, I'm not sure if I should, but I will anyhow. I'm occasionally, or more than occasionally, in correspondence with the producer of one of the programs in Al Manar. And she very generously sends me Mr. Nasrallah's speeches, which I post. And in recent months, I've been much more, by the way, anything I'm telling you, they know, I mean they, because international email is, you know, monitored. And in recent weeks, I've been much more bold in my criticisms. And I say, you know, this is a very poor translation. You really should work on getting good translations of the speeches, because How many people read them in English? I guess nobody here. They're terrible. The translations, the Al-Munawwar, they've been awful. And I tell them, you really should get the translations improved. And then the last one, the one from September 17th, it was much better. And then I got a little bit bolder, and I said, you know, I listened to Nasrallah's September 17th speech, or I read it, and I said, there were factual errors there. The blue lines on the Israeli flag, they do not represent the Tigris and the Euphrates. They are the blue bars of the Jewish prayer shawl. It's incorrect. Well, I figured they're not going to like that, but I don't care. Because I respect Nasrallah too much to want him to make publicly silly statements. I want him to be exactly accurate because I know he's capable of it, and I know he wants to be. And, okay, but most people, yours truly included, don't take criticism too well. And my criticism was pretty blunt. I was very surprised. 3 days later, I get an email from her, this woman who I correspond with, and she said, please send all your factual corrections as soon as you can. I will forward them to Sheikh Nasrallah. And I was really very impressed. He cares about the facts. He cares about being accurate. He cares about being truthful. And we should, I think, take inspiration from that fact. I cannot say, in all honesty, since the topic has come up and we should have an open discussion and not a censored discussion, I read President Ahmadinejad's speech at the UN, and I have to say my heart dropped. It was terrible. It was just awful. I mean, all this talk about a handful of Zionists, and everyone knows he means Jews, a handful of Zionists controlling the international economic system. It was just pure silliness. It was so devoid of intellectual, scholarly content. It was devoid of truth. And you would never, it's inconceivable that Sheikh Nasrallah would deliver a speech like that. It really is. I mean, just look at his speech during the Lebanon War. He said, it was quite surprising. He said, this is not a Zionist war. He said, the Zionists are just the executioners. He said, it's an American war. It's the Americans who are behind all of this. And that took a certain amount of courage to say. You know, when you start saying the Jews control everything, well, you know, people like Bush love that. It means the Bushes, the Rumsfelds, the Cheneys, they're all off the hook. They have nothing to do with anything. It's just a handful of Jews who control everything. You know, that's a very easy out for the American ruling elites. But Nasrallah doesn't do that. And I think that's what we have to do. Stick by the facts and try as best we can to avoid the easy victories from cheap rhetoric. Well, I have more to say, but the hour is pressing, and now comes the more engaging part, because I get to hear what you have to say. And I hope there will be absolute candor, absolute honesty. I'm not afraid to hear anything. I want to hear what you have to say, and then hopefully you'll also hear what I have to say. Thank you.